Hey, 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 guys. Welcome to Building This Community.
This is your city business and policy development podcast. We're your hosts,
Luke Patrick
and Andrew Klump. Welcome to this week's episode of Building This Community. Our guests today are Melissa and Chris Bruntlett, who are the co-founders of Medacity and co-authors of Building the Cycling City, the Dutch Blueprint for Urban Vitality. Melissa, Chris, how are you?
Oh, we're doing pretty well.
It's great to be here. Yeah, greetings from across the Atlantic.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us all the way in the Netherlands today. We are very appreciative of having you on. Can you just, I gave a little bit of an overview of what you all have done, but can you give us a little bit more about your background?
Yeah, sure. Not the most traditional background when it comes to people working in mobility advocacy and urban planning sort of realms. I myself studied fashion design in Toronto at the same time that Chris was studying architecture. And through a series of moves, we found ourselves in Vancouver. Around the time that the city was putting a lot of investments into walking and cycling, and specifically into creating the start of a cycling network or a separated cycling network. And as a result of choices, including deciding to sell our car and living in a very walkable and bikeable community, we found ourselves falling into cycling advocacy that basically grew and grew over the years to become what defined us more so than what we studied.
Yeah, and that's kind of out of that work came Medacity, which was a small consultancy Melissa and I started as a two-person operation, creating communications plan, social media content, photography, video, writing, all in this this area, lobbying for change in cities. And it was through that process we ended up coming to the Netherlands to write what was initially intended as a series of blog posts for a Vancouver-based digital publication. And that quickly snowballed into dozens of articles, a book that took us touring around the world, and subsequently landed us here working for organizations in the Netherlands that are now exporting this knowledge and expertise in the field of cycling internationally.
So what kind of made you get into writing and publishing about this rather than just the consultancy aspect of your career?
Well, I mean, part of how we got started in this was wanting to share the stories that were often overlooked. And we wanted to communicate with people who, like us, hadn't learned all the technical terms and weren't fully immersed in mobility planning. And so that became our goal in terms of the blogging that we used to do. But then when it came to the book, it was taking these ideas that are often quite technical, over the heads of the average person, and packaging them in a way that whether they're people that are interested in mobility but don't quite know where to start in terms of advocating, or even, you know, right up to counselors and mayors whose backgrounds are not in urban planning, to help them understand what had happened here in a way, in language that made sense to them, as opposed to, you know, more high level tech speak.
Our mantra was always share the stories, not the statistics. And we found the city itself was so focused on talking about how many people were using the bike lanes and mode share percentages. And we felt the success stories of people that started cycling as a result of the infrastructure, the businesses that were benefiting from it, those stories weren't being shared. And so it was a matter of picking the medium for the message. And sometimes it was articles, sometimes it was short videos, but we thought we brought a very kind of positive and emotive message to what was a very heated argument at times. And when you're talking about the reallocation of road space, there's a lot of very strong opinions on every side.
Well, I think you all are touching a little bit too on why, you know, Luke and I enjoy doing this podcast, is that we recognize that policy oftentimes can be very situational. And I think it's incredibly important what you all have done then, and really tell the stories of the impact of what people are seeing with that. So with that, why is bike infrastructure so important to city development.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's much more than transportation. We say it's much more than just mobility. It's about participation in society. And right now, built a lot of cities around the world where in order to participate in society, you have to have a driver's license and a functioning automobile. And that excludes huge segments of the population, from children to the elderly, to people with less economic means, to people with physical disabilities. It leaves them on the sidelines and reliant on other people for their mobility needs. And as we've seen here in the Netherlands firsthand, once you start building cycling infrastructure and you give those people a means to autonomously transport themselves from A to B, they're suddenly able to do their own shopping, visit the doctor, the community center, maintain an active social life. There's all these amazing health and happiness benefits that come with just being able to use your streets at a human level. And that's what motivates us and keeps us pushing to help other cities around the world achieve this kind of Dutch level of success.
Yeah, I think for us, a lot of it comes down to accessibility, and not in solely in when we're looking at people with limited mobility, whether they have injuries or longstanding disabilities, more just that access to the city, regardless of your income, your influence, your background, your race, your age, anything. It's so important. And a lot of the stories that we've heard through over the years have been about people that have found a level of freedom because the city has been designed in a way to let them be in control of how they can move, as Chris said. And we've heard more of those stories since moving here from people that probably aren't who people would expect to say, like, the bike lanes, I don't ride a bike, but they make it so that I can have access to the city in the way that I want to, and to maintain that independence and freedom. And so, you know, whether on a bike or not, this infrastructure plays a role in making cities a place for everyone to have that ownership of how they move around.
Well, that's awesome, guys, and I couldn't agree more. But when we're talking about the U.S. and building bikeable communities, it's obviously a pretty abrupt, pretty dramatic change from what people have experienced. Do you think a culture shift is going to be required to make Americans comfortable with this new perspective?
I think certainly there is a bit of a culture shift that needs, I shouldn't say a bit. We lived in Canada for long enough to know it's a big culture shift that needs to happen. But I think that if you focus less so on making on the fact that we're making things more bikeable, but the fact that we're making things more accessible to everyone. So you're providing these options coupled with programming that is going to support people that are unsure, maybe have never ridden a bike or don't have the means to get a bike. You know, there's all sorts of services that have to come into play and programming to help move that along, but it's not impossible. And it's happening in countless cities, not just in North America, but around the world, where when that emphasis starts to happen around making things a little more accessible, more bikeable, more walkable, you see that shift from the more car-dominated mindset to one that's more about creating places for people, essentially.
It's not just America. You know, we look across the pond to the UK, just across the border to Belgium and France and Germany. Cycling is still a niche activity in a lot of those places. It's still seen as sport and recreation. And that's because it's been designed that way. The streets have been designed that way to prioritize car movement. And as a result, cycling isn't something that people see they could do to the go to the corner store or to school or to wherever they happen to be traveling in their neighborhood. And so there does have to be this kind of discussion and a cultural shift, if you will, to show what's possible with the right bicycle and the right bicycle infrastructure, how they could run their lives, not with out the car completely, but with fewer car trips.
Well, and so, you know, from my perspective, I am not a cyclist, but I am a big advocate of changing our streets to allow for more cycling. And one thing I continually tell people that, you know, our mayor, who's been under a lot of criticism lately in Louisville, has even gotten the nickname from the beginning of Mayor McBike Lane from a lot of people that despise bike lanes in the city. And one thing I continue to tell those people is, well, if you don't like riding behind people on bikes, you should at least get them out of your way and get them in bike lanes so they're protected, you're protected, and you're not having to, you know, interfere with each other as much. You know, just that simple step. What do you see as tools to be able to change that culture that you've seen from the various cities that you've been in?
I mean, I think that's a loaded question.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I think, you know, in some of the more successful cities that we've seen over the years, I think a lot of what will help those culture shifts is presenting the opportunities that will come from investing in cycling. And so the fact that it's not just about making things safer for cyclists, but also you're now creating a safer environment in the pedestrian realm for people who aren't on bikes but aren't driving. Now they're even that much more separated from the road space, and it's much more comfortable. And I think one of the things that Chris and I also think is important is to shift away when we're talking about cycling from the commute to work. And I think that, you know, everyone so often focuses on how people get to work, but they don't see the opportunities that walking and cycling bring to those much more shorter trips that people take, that are a larger part of how we move through the city. And so if we can focus more on that and the opportunities that the infrastructure brings to those trips, that make it much more accessible to the average person as opposed to just people that are willing to cycle to work.
We're a big fans of just trying stuff. And I think that's perhaps the best strategy a city can use, is just to try things. And whether it's pop-up infrastructure, pop-up bike lanes, open streets events, at least pre-COVID, where we could, you know, close a few blocks to cars and open them up to people and allow people to experience their streets a little bit differently. Bike sharing schemes where people can borrow a bike and take it for a short journey just for a few dollars. These are all kind of Trojan horses, if you will, to get people thinking differently about their mobility, and hopefully stir that latent demand that exists for safer streets and for more choices when it comes to our transportation.
Well, I certainly think people need to think differently. But as Andrew pointed out, there certainly is going to be some pushback and opposition when you want to make these large scale changes in a city to kind of accommodate for a more bikeable environment. What kind of role do you think tactical urbanism plays in mitigating those criticisms? And could you maybe explain what tactical urbanism is?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think we'll both agree that tactical urbanism plays a really big role in showing people what's possible, because in its very nature, what it is just testing out ideas. There are pilots, there are temporary measures. There's there are a couple of extra bollards thrown up just to show test bike lanes or test public spaces. So they're not permanent. They can change. They can be adapted based on, you know, how people are using the space. But what they do and what we've seen them do in countless cities is show the possibilities. And so people are often much more agreeable to these temporary interventions because they know they're temporary. But once it's tested out, once they see it in action, suddenly they view that space differently and they understand what it is you're trying to achieve. And so I think Calgary, Alberta is one of the cases we talk about in the book that's probably a really good example of that, where it wasn't necessarily tactical urbanism, but rather a pilot bike lane network in the downtown that, due to the success, due to the number of people that saw it and said, I'm going to give this a try, is now a permanent fixture in the city, in the downtown of Calgary. So, you know, just showing what was possible was enough to start them on a path towards creating more cycling friendly facilities.
Well, and the Calgary example also gave, most importantly, the politicians an out. So they agreed to this 18-month pilot project. They would study it, they would adapt it and adjust it as needed. And then after 18 months, if it didn't work, the politicians could pull the plug and remove it, no harm, no foul. Now, you know, they measured it, people flocked to it, 1.2 million new bicycle trips, simply by reallocating 2% of the road network in the city center. And ultimately, you know, more councillors voted to make it permanent than did to even try the project to begin with. So it's one of these instances where we can, by trying things, instead of sitting around and arguing about drawings and renderings and sketches, just put down some cones and concrete barriers and temporary traffic lights and see what happens. And more often than not, you will see that people use it, people enjoy it, and people will vote for politicians that will expand it.
Well, I definitely think that those are all great ideas, but I guess kind of the basis of this whole conversation is city accessibility. And I know the majority of your all's writing is centered on bikes and bikeability, but what on top, you know, above and beyond bikeability can cities do to increase their accessibility?
It's one of the great paradoxes of transportation planning, and it's about reducing the amount of space dedicated to cars and increasing the amount of space for buses, bikes, trams, pedestrians, and other modes of transportation. And I think, you know, again, having expanded streets and parking for 50 years, we realized that you can never actually build enough. And it actually causes a lot of problems, not the least of which is gridlock and congestion. When you start giving people choices and using more space efficient modes of transport, that's suddenly when things can start moving. And we give, again, mobility to people that don't necessarily have a driver's license or the economic means to drive. So it's obviously not just about the bicycle in and of itself, but how it fits into this suite of options. And there are more and more choices now coming with kick scooters and all electric bikes and all these different various modes. But at the backbone of all of that in every great city is a great public transportation network. And we would certainly be big proponents of designing the various mobility systems in coordination with one another instead of just focusing on them individually.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Can you guys explain this concept? It's gained a lot of steam in urban planning circles recently, the idea of a 15 or 20 minute city.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think at its core, from the way it's been presented, most notably in Paris, is the idea of creating an urban fabric where anybody, regardless of age, ability, et cetera, can access what they need to within a 15-minute walk or bike from their home. So it basically creates this radius around their home base to access the things that they need. Yeah, in an easy way that doesn't require them to get in a car. And the unfortunate thing about most suburban cities is the way that the planning has been created and the policies behind it really have hindered that for a long time, but it doesn't mean that it can't change. And it doesn't mean that every single amenity needs to be within 15 minutes, but I mean, that's obviously the ultimate goal. So I think when I'm thinking about it in terms of a more North American or more suburban K context, it's identifying some of the core services that can be accessed within that 15 minutes. And then looking at how in the future we can change land use in a way that enables more amenities to be closer to where people live, you know, where they work even. So making it easier for people to get to stuff without having to travel long distances or without having to hop in the car every time they want to get, for example, a jug of milk or take kids to activities.
The reason we're big proponents of the bicycle in that concept of the 15-minute city is that it essentially extends your range by five times with the same time and effort. So you may be willing to walk a kilometer or so in that period of time. You can actually cycle five times that. And as a result, your range extends. So when we talk about cycling to public transport, suddenly you can feed five times as many customers, 5 kilometer radius, as many customers. Sorry, I didn't explain that very well. Your catchment area becomes 5 times larger, 25 times larger.
You're getting lost in the numbers.
No worries.
A 1 kilometer radius from a train station suddenly becomes a 5 kilometer radius just by adding a bike into the option. So now people from as far away as 5 kilometers in all directions can access that same point. And that really exponentially increases the number of people that can be served by one transit hub.
So there's some amazing statistics from here in the Netherlands that 81% of the population lives within a 15-minute bike ride of a train station. There was a more recent study that 83% of the neighborhoods could be considered 15-minute cities when you take cycling into consideration because of the extended range it offers and the great bike infrastructure. So while it would be ideal that we all had these amenities within a 15-minute walk, it may be a harder stretch. The easier thing may be to provide great bike infrastructure, extend our range a little bit, and allow us to cycle to those destinations. So the bike is maybe a little hack that we can use in creating these 15-minute cities.
I think what's really important to remember, and I think oftentimes in mobility advocacy, we get caught up when we're thinking about bike infrastructure with thinking solely of separated infrastructure. And one of the key things in the Netherlands is that most of the great bike infrastructure, quote unquote, is actually just traffic calm streets. It's just streets with a speed of 30 kilometers or less, some treatments to stop cars from going fast in a straight direction. So whether that's chicanes or bulge outs to make people move a little more serpentine in a street to slow them down. It's not necessarily building separated cycle tracks on every single street, but rather slowing traffic where it makes sense on your neighborhood streets and separating it where it makes sense, and inversely on things like your major arterials or places where cars need to move faster because of the efficiency of how all these modes need to move through a city. And so in that respect, when we're talking about a 15-minute city, when it comes to bikes, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to have this robust separated bike network to access all these amenities within 15 minutes. It could be as simple as making a street a little more traffic calmed, which at the same time will also benefit people not cycling who just want to enjoy that streetscape at a much calmer, more human level.
Yeah. And honestly, currently I'm working on a project called Prosper Preston, where we're trying to redevelop what's called Preston Highway in Louisville that goes straight in past, you know, residential commercial districts, but it's a state-owned highway, so it does create conflict between the city and the state. But what you're talking about in adding curvatures, finding ways to slow down traffic, you know, those are things that I see firsthand consistently. But the thing that I want to really nail down here is, do you think that bikeability is more important for this 15-20 minute city in America than it is maybe for Europe, simply because we are more car centric and more sprawled in America than anywhere else? That seems to be my biggest challenge right now.
Yeah, it's hard. I think it's somewhat dangerous sometimes to focus just on bikeability. And I think that's what Chris and I really try to emphasize, is that there's not one mode to solve every single trip. And so if it's rather looking at how making things more cycle friendly in combination with, say, public transport or walking to achieve those distances, you'll probably be able to reach more people, especially thinking of, you know, the North American context where cycle mode share is quite low. It's going to take time. And so if we can show people that and really emphasize the fact that it's not just one mode, that can be a start. I think it would be fantastic if every city suddenly became bikeable. Obviously, that's why I moved to the Netherlands. But I also think that we need to be realistic and understand that not everybody's going to get on a bike. And so if we can somehow show them that it's not just one mode, but a combination of various modes, then we might be closer to reaching that 15 or 20 minute city.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that actually plays in well to the hierarchy of transportation options that you all described in your book, where the Netherlands, cars are the last thing that city planners are asked to think about when designing their cities, you know, with pedestrians and bicycles, public transport coming before that. Do you think that that model in general would be adaptable to the U.S. when we know that there is going to be some aversion to that type of change?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of U.S. cities are adapting it, at least on paper. In reality, you know, it may be a little bit differently, look a little bit different, because as you've indicated, once you start removing parking spaces and reallocating space on the street or reprioritizing your traffic lights and intersections, you're going to get a lot of pushback. But it's not about, as we often say, banning the car, punishing car drivers, wagging your finger at them. The car has, the rate of car ownership here in the Netherlands is just as high as anywhere else in Europe. They do use their cars. They love them here. They just have also designed these mobility systems that complement the car network. And as a result, you know, as an aside, they've got some of the lowest levels of traffic congestion and highest levels of driver satisfaction in the world because they built all these alternatives into their city. But it does come down to what is the city for, who should be prioritized for these short journeys within the city of just a couple of kilometers. Should we make it easier for people to drive, or should we perhaps recirculate that through traffic to the perimeter, make it a bit more indirect to drive the car and give the people on foot and bicycle the more direct route? And I think that's something that cities in the Netherlands do really well, is this kind of idea of filtered permeability and traffic circulation to make driving just that little bit more uncomfortable, so that walking and cycling is the natural choice. You certainly can still drive, and lots of people do, as we said, but you're kind of nudged to make the rider decision for those shorter trips within your city. And it comes down to how the access is allowed through certain streets and how the traffic is circulated around the city, so that it's kept, the through traffic's kept away from the sensitive residential areas and commercial areas and the like, and it's not allowed to impact on the livability of the city, and that's something that we've really appreciated since we moved here and started living as residents in Delft here in the Netherlands.
I mean, make no mistake, we fully understand the challenge that exists in a, you know, outside of major city centers in the U.S. and in Canada and elsewhere in the world, because the way the urban farm has been designed has not necessarily encouraged, for example, greater public transport access. And I realize it's going to take a while, I think, to find that investment again, especially as people are a little uncertain about using public transport right now. But I think understanding how that will improve things and provide more options, even in further out areas, the exurbs, suburbs, what have you, public transport definitely has a role to play there. An investment in that will be just as important in a lot of places as investing in cycling.
So with that, you know, that hierarchy seems to be incredibly important. During COVID, we've seen restaurants in particular reclaim more of the street and the sidewalks, which, you know, American streets are wider than I would say a lot of European streets. But that can cause some issues with, you know, leaving enough space for pedestrians, for public transit, bike lanes. What do you see as kind of the issues with restaurants taking more spaces versus, and obviously you need more people to be able to eat outside during COVID, but what do you see as kind of issues and solutions with some of that space?
Well, controversial take. I think that maybe the space needs to be taken from the cars, given over to the restaurants but still being able to provide more public space. So change them from car dominated streets to possibly even just pedestrianized streets. I mean, that's a really big jump, but yeah, I want to be really careful with saying that restaurants taking up that space is an issue, because I think, like we were talking about tactical urbanism earlier, these restaurants, these outdoor patios are showing people that those streets can be used for something else. And so I think if we just at first it was very reactionary, but now I think if we can take stock of those spaces and how we can better allocate and possibly reduce the space for the more dangerous modes and create more space for staying and enjoying those streets, in my opinion, they'll only be the better for it in the long run if you've created that space for gathering for community and commerce as opposed to just driving through.
I mean, I think Rotterdam is a great example. And this is, you know, this was the first chapter of our book, and it's a city that we try to take as many people to as possible because it's the most American city in the Netherlands. It was flattened during the Second World War, rebuilt around the automobile, and is one of the more car-dominated cities in the Netherlands, with really wide streets and lots of on-street parking. And it absolutely transformed itself during the corona crisis. It basically gave businesses carte blanche to take as much on-street parking as they wanted, and would actually build them a parklet for free using materials that the city had on hand. And as a result, over 1,000 parking spaces, I believe, were reallocated for dining throughout the summer, with no permits or regulation required. And it really transformed the city. And this is a place that, again, has lots of space for cars, really dedicated tram and busways that run through the center of the city. They've really struck a balance between the various modalities that make it a really different feeling city than most others in the Netherlands. But to an American or a Canadian or to someone else from elsewhere in the world, it feels really familiar to them. And I think it shows that these kinds of balances can be made where the car is still present, just not as dominant as perhaps we've allowed it to be for the past 50 or 60 years.
Well, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And we're starting to wind down here a little bit, but you've given us some great perspectives, some great ways to improve our cities and streets in this conversation today. But one thing that I want to hit on before we wrap up is, you all have seen the political process, the street redesign process in numerous cities now. What can average citizens do to increase bikeability and accessibility of their cities?
Well, I mean, I think it comes down to demanding that space. And a lot of the cities that we've seen change over time to become more walking and cycling friendly have done so because people kept demanding it. People kept pushing back, and it's never easy. And we still do it now. We still feel like we're repeating the same messages that we started giving and when we started this journey over 10 years ago. But repeating those messages and making sure that the politicians understand that this is what you want in your city is one of the key ways of hopefully getting to a point where you can start to achieve that and realize, see it realized in your city. And oftentimes those people that start out as advocates and start out as the ones demanding that space end up becoming the same people that start running for office and start being the change makers in their city. We saw it in Vancouver. We've seen it in other cities where the people that we met in the early days became the people that started running for office in order to be the change they wanted to see in their city.
This doesn't happen without a fight. I mean, that's the bad news, but the good news is that you can make it happen. You just have to get involved in that fight. And fight is a word that I tend to avoid, but once you start talking about changing the status quo and inconveniencing a mode of transport that's been the focus of our urban development and transportation planning for so many years, you're going to get a vocal minority, and we need to assure the politicians that they are, in fact, just a vocal minority. It may result in some very heated claims, some really outrageous actions. Right now, there's a lot of vandalism and happening in London, and death threats over the low traffic neighborhoods that that they're trying to implement. But at the end of the day, they need to know that there is a fairly quiet majority, 60 to 70% of your city, that would love to, you know, have a safe space to walk or cycle, and for their children to walk or cycle. And politicians need to know that those people exist, and they will continue to vote for them. So it's up to us as advocates to give those people voice, and support the politicians and help them push through the controversy, because inevitably there will be controversy that they need to push through to get to the other side.
I think another really important message within that is to find your advocates that maybe aren't, or find your partners that maybe aren't in the walking and cycling world. And when we were doing the research for the first book, we found that a lot of the change that happened here in the Netherlands was not because they had a very, very powerful bike lobby, but rather they had a bunch of different groups working together, all working towards the same goal, whether it was the Historical Society, whether it was mothers for the Stop the Kindermord movement, teachers, the health professionals, all those people coming together and advocating for one single thing, which was to stop making space for cars and start making space, or bringing the space back to that for the people. That was what created the change. And, you know, there's a lot of us out there in cycling advocacy for sure, but if we can find people working in public health, people working for social justice, and start working together for a common goal, then it'll be a lot easier to achieve the final outcome of cities that are built for everyone.
That makes a lot of sense, and I'm glad to hear you all encouraging people to continue to be involved and let their voices be heard, because ultimately that's the way I see change happening for anything in any industry or any area. But before we go, I want to just give you a chance to kind of promote what anything you're working on. I know you have your book out now that's Building the Cycling City, the Dutch Blueprint for Urban Vitality, and that you have another book coming out in 2021. So the floor is yours.
Rather than, you know, try to find time to relax and stay sane during the lockdown back in the spring, Chris and I sat down and penned a second book. And the title of that book is Curbing Traffic, the Human Case for Fewer Cars in Our Lives. And that will come out at the end of June of 2021. And that book takes a step away just from looking at cycling, but rather looking at the whole mobility picture and how, and the role that cars play, not just in terms of the safety of moving around a city, but what it does to us on a very human level, to our mental health, our physical health, our stress, our social connection, and looking at how our experience of the city has changed since moving to Delft, and finding lessons in that that can be hopefully transferred to cities everywhere.
So it's a little bit of our personal story, our experiences, our children's experiences, going from a neighborhood in Vancouver, Canada, where there were 150,000 cars a day driving through, to our new neighborhood here in Delft, where there's 1,500 cars passing through. So 1% of the traffic, and trying to document what the impact of that reduction in cars in our families' lives has been. On our, as Melissa said, our physical and mental well-being, and our mobility, as well as our neighbors and some of our fellow citizens. And we're quite proud of the stories that we've woven together, and we hope it's, especially now in a post-COVID world where people have experienced these kind of low traffic streets firsthand, to explain some of the more subtle benefits of them, ideas such as noise pollution and something that we just accept in our lives and don't really think about, but to explain what the impact of that is on us as human beings, and what we have to benefit from reducing it. And yeah, as we said, we'll hopefully connect again in the new year when the book is ready, and we can have another conversation about the research and the stories that we put together for that particular project.
Absolutely. I can't wait to have you guys back on. I can't wait to get my hands on that new book. You know, I was pleasantly engrossed by Building Cycling City. I just devoured it in you know, 2 days. But we unfortunately have to wrap this interview up. Before we let you guys go, Andrew and I always like to ask our guests the final question. And normally it goes, what's one policy you'd like to change in Louisville? But I'm going to broaden it for you guys a little bit, because you've kind of globetrotted in your journey to spread the word about cycling. I guess, what's one policy you'd like to see changed in the communities that you've lived?
Reflecting on the second book, because I had just written the read the manuscript again, I was really struck by how much of the problems we've created for ourselves as a society come down to the fact that the transportation profession, as it currently stands, is not at all representative of the people who use the transportation networks and live in the city. It's almost 90% male, for example, predominantly white. And as a result, the people that are designing roads, streets, you know, bike lanes, bus lanes, and subways and highways are designing with a windshield worldview based on their personal experience and completely neglecting the lived experience of huge segments of the population, whether they're part-time workers, shift workers, women, obviously children, and various other demographics that are really left to fend for themselves. And I can't help but think if we involve more of those people in the transportation profession and then in the public engagement process, if we asked children what they wanted their streets to look like, if we asked the elderly what they wanted their streets to look like, that we wouldn't end up with a significantly different city. So that's kind of maybe a bit of a pipe dream than a specific policy. But I think one thing we've really gained an appreciation for, and we write about this in the second book, is cities are really great at measuring the trips that people take, but we completely fail to take into consideration the trips that they don't take. And this comes down to, again, not having a feeling safe or comfortable on your streets, or not having a bus route or a train route to get you where you want to go. And as a result, there's a lot of journeys that a lot of people don't make because of the way that their city is designed. And if we start looking at those trips and journeys and start planning for those, again, I think we'd end up with a very different city than what we currently have. And I can see Melissa scratching her chin, and I think she's going to hopefully build on that idea.
No, I think you stole my answer. I mean, I think, well, it's funny because Chris focused on the women aspect, which is usually my answer. So I'm going to steal his in terms of, I think, one of the things that we wrote about in the second book, and Chris already mentioned, that we talk about noise pollution. I think that every city needs to create a policy around what is an acceptable level of noise in our cities. The WHO has a set guideline for what is acceptable, what people can handle. And I think we just take it as, like, you know, you live in a big city or you live near a busy road. This is just the level of noise that you have to deal with. And, you know, as Chris also mentioned, during COVID, we've experienced these really quiet cities where you hear the bird song, you hear kids playing outside, all those sounds that, you know, bring a lot of people a lot of joy, and that we just are okay living without. And I think cities, if they can take seriously the noise levels that are happening in and around where people are living and staying and supposed to be enjoying life around them, and actually develop a policy that says, okay, if people live here, this is the maximum amount, and anything over that, if that's happening, we need to change the way the street's made. We need to change how traffic moves through it to make it more comfortable. Then that would go a long way to making cities a lot more enjoyable for so many more people. And also nicely ties into cycling, because cycling makes very little noise on the street, and definitely walking. And so in the long run, basically just creating more walking and cycling friendly cities.
Yeah, I mean, the noise pollution aspect, you know, I live in a quote unquote bird sanctuary, and there's been discussions and studies that have talked about in the past about how, you know, prolonged noise pollution can make bird populations migrate elsewhere. So, that, I mean, that is a major, major concern. And to Chris's point, too, I think also talking, not just talking about diversity of opinions and voices being included, but actually doing that is incredibly important. So I think both points that you all made were fantastic. But with that said, we appreciate you all coming on our episode, and we look forward to next time with when your new book gets released.
Yeah, no, absolutely, guys. I can't wait to get my hands on it. Like I said,
I think we've teased some of the themes out enough, but we're really excited to get it out in the world and start talking about it, because writing this book changed us as people, and we hope that our readers have the same experience. But for now, Building the Cycling City is available at your bookstore, and we'd certainly invite you to pick that up and tide you over in the meantime.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Thank you.
We'll pick back up with our reaction segment after a word from our sponsor.
Well, Luke, again, another great episode, this time from an international guest all the way in Delft, Netherlands. And they provided a lot of insight into one biking, city building, city planning, especially in their old book, Building a Cycling City. And I'm excited. This is only part one of what will be probably at least a two-part series once they release their book in the spring of 2021. But with that said, Luke, what stood out to you about this?
Well, I really liked everything they had to say. I personally think bikes should take a much higher place in urban design in America. And we've seen investments from cities across the U.S. You know, they talk about it throughout their book, of examples like Austin recently as 2016, they allocated $46 million via mobility bonds to exclusively improve bike infrastructure throughout their city, you know, and they gave examples from Boston and San Francisco and even here in Louisville. As much criticism as Greg Fisher has caught for his expansion of bike infrastructure, if we could maybe find a way to connect the current lanes, the lanes that he is overseeing the development of, I think we really would have a much more bikeable city. And I know that's not the only thing. It's part of a multimodal approach to try and create an accessible city. But I really think that biking, it's very high up in the order of things that we need to account for.
And to your point, Luke, right? If you, this list of cities you just named, I'll give you a little secret. Those are some of the hottest places people want to move to. Austin, Texas is becoming like a tech hub. You know, Boston, San Francisco, they're huge. They're places where people want to move to. And they're putting in these philosophies in part because they're copying it from a lot of what Europe is trying to do. But people are recognizing that 15-minute city is integral, and you can really expand that with bikes, like Chris mentioned throughout this interview. But that infrastructure is so incredibly important. And then also what you said, and we mentioned this in the interview, the issue with Louisville versus other cities is there doesn't really seem to be a plan. We're going to slap all these down, which is great, and eventually maybe they connect, but they're not getting the usage rate right now because they don't connect. And it's if you try to use some, you're forced into awkward or more dangerous, high risk areas as far as bike on a street without a bike lanes, as we currently sit.
And another part of it, and I think we talked about it in the interview, is kind of a cultural shift. We need Americans to be conscious of what bike lanes mean and the respect we need to pay towards bikers on the road. I think as a car-driven society, as a country where automobile has clearly won, like the transportation war dominates like the planning process in any city planning meeting, it's tough to get people to care about bike lanes. And I think one way you could force the subject, you could just make people address this is some kind of tactical urbanism, maybe shutting off portions of the downtown, or simply creating like a street diet where you maybe limit the lanes on a given highway by, you know, one or two if it's a four lane, and giving that area back to the businesses that are along it, you know, giving them access to a broader area to serve their clientele, like an easier, more walkable, more bikeable street. Like, those are the kinds of things that I think will drive a shift in our understanding and our association with biking in America.
Yeah. And at least in Louisville, you're seeing more of, okay, well, we got approval from this couple block stretch. We're going to put in a really good segregated bike lane, or which has happened a couple of times, or just put in a bike lane period. A couple of times we've seen them they're just thrown in ditches almost along major streets where they're going in and out of drains. So you're seeing that. You're not seeing tactical urbanism as much, but with COVID, we're finally starting to see tactical urbanism used, not necessarily for bikes, but to help with restaurants, which I know cities across the country are doing. You're seeing, you know, Monic, for example, in Louisville, in the Germantown area, they had these rubber barriers put out to where what used to be maybe six parking spots now is space for a number of tables. And hopefully, you know, in my opinion, hopefully that's permanent, because they didn't really need the parking there. You know, people could park a little bit closer to the restaurant, but they didn't really need the parking. And hopefully in the future, you could put up a decent looking, you know, black fence, maybe with some potted plants hanging from something to even more beautify the area. And it really just makes these streets and these sidewalks more walkable, more appealing, when you don't have to have tables taking up the sidewalks. Now, I get COVID, you have to, like, we have to make the exception for that, I mean, because we have to help our restaurants survive. But using tactical urbanism to expand into the streets, to see how we can use that space more effectively for purposes other than just pure transportation, to me is absolutely integral.
I think some businesses maybe are of the mindset that they need to be along a major road because they need the traffic driving by. But the reality is, like, if we could steal some of that street back for the sidewalk, back for bikers, back for pedestrians, like, what would it mean? What would the difference be of, you know, cars driving by, not being able to look in your window, not being able to get an understanding of your business, versus somebody walking past it might actually be intrigued by what you have to offer and to stop by.
And you're right. And part of this is just such a design driven conversation, because there's even studies that show that, you know, streets with trees that have big trees that line the streets, people drive slower, because the more large vertical objects you have closer to the street, the more narrow the street feels. So even if you have the same type of street, but you have, for example, a storefront all the way up closer to the curb, people are going to drive slower. So this goes back to, well, why does every single building have to have the parking lot accessible from the front? It's because businesses want people to think, oh, well, parking's easy here. You can just slide right in and then go into the store and come right back out. Instead, it needs to be more of a philosophy change of, oh, the expectation is parking is always in the rear, that if we were to build all of our buildings more towards the front and people just always assumed that there was parking in the back, then you'd have better design to where people would want to walk up and down. You don't have to worry about cars coming in and out constantly of parking lots into the street. Because this is getting even more nuanced and even more in the weeds. But if you want to do a segregated bike lane, you can't have curb cuts every 10 feet, because then what's the point of the segregated bike lane? Because you'd have 4 feet, 5 feet of divider, and then a gap, and then another.
You'd just be swerving back and forth, you know, the whole
time. Exactly. So it doesn't truly make sense to put in infrastructure if you're not going to have the zoning and the code match up along with it. And this just seems to mirror at least Louisville's bike plan of, okay, here's a bunch of really good ideas, but nothing is doing it collaboratively in conjunction with each other.
Absolutely. And another issue is, I don't want to solely get focused on biking and pedestrian speeds. As much as biking was clearly a discussion of today's topic, of today's interview, I think it's just one part of a broader discussion about making cities accessible, walkable, traversable. The other thing is public transit. By shifting from bus lanes, as we talked in an earlier interview with Gil Holland about the difference between a kind of fluid bus lane structure versus a light rail that businesses can attach themselves to, and the benefit they get in being able to plan long term. You know, a bus lane, if you know there's a stop immediately in front of your business, that could change as quickly as the city, you know, chooses to. But if they lay a light rail system, you're able to plan long term and know that you're going to have a consistent stop, a consistent number of potential customers of citizens passing past your business, and that's going to incentivize a lot of people to build along these rail lines, and it's going to give the city itself like a more accessible feel.
I've said for a long time that accessibility is one of the most important tools in creating equity throughout our city or cities across the country, because accessibility allows for more equity in healthcare, in job development, in education. But if you taper off accessibility by not having public transportation, by not having a cyclable city, then you have people that are very confined to their regions and they don't necessarily all grow in the same manner. With that said, the aspect of infrastructure that I think a common detraction from putting down maybe something like light rail is that people say, oh, well, we don't have the density for light rail. And that's just not an accurate statement. It's more of like a chicken and the egg thing, because, for example, in Salt Lake City, before they hosted the Olympics, they put down light rail in anticipation of the Olympics. And guess what has happened since? There's been density growing around where those light rail were put down. And it's the same thing that you see with our highway systems. Why is it that every single like exit in by a highway seems to have more development? It's because wherever there is an interchange of people, you're always going to have more development, whether that's light rail, whether that's, you know, expressway or whatever. But light rail provides more equity and more accessibility because it's an easier to operate modem of transportation.
Yeah. And I have family that lives out in Salt Lake, and I can attest that it's currently one of the hottest real estate markets in the country, as well as like, it is just a noticeably accessible city. There's a sense of ease of getting around the entire downtown area that you don't experience many places. And it's in part due to the rail system, but also a very bikeable, very open city plan that I don't think many cities have been able to replicate.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I do want to focus on cycling a little bit. And that was still the main point of our interview.
It was the topic, right?
But we have to recognize too, how I think Chris made this unbelievable point that the 15-minute city, right? The idea that you can get to anything you need within 15 minutes, no matter where you are, where you live in your neighborhood, is an unbelievable aspirational goal for every city to do, because it's not just green. It's also better for your family because, you know, think about it. If you want to go to the doctor, if you want to go out to eat, if you want to, you know, go to the grocery, if you need to go to the hardware store, whatever, having everything accessible to you within 15 minutes is an unbelievable luxury, but it's also extraordinarily beneficial for the environment as well, right? So it has so many benefits. But with that said, what Chris brought up about the fact that when you start finding ways to incorporate bikes into that, one, it makes the 15-minute city that much easier because you're still doing it in a green way. But two, you're able to expand where your zones are and connect the city much faster. You don't have to wait for as much development to connect because you're using bicycles to expand that 15-minute city.
Absolutely. I almost think of all this talk of light rail. I think it has to be in conjunction with bikes. I almost picture it as in airlines, there's kind of that hub and spoke system. Like you have a centralized travel hub that then feeds all of its surrounding areas. And that's kind of, I think, what you get in Holland. There are massive bike share platforms surrounding all of their major transit hubs and all of their major rail stops. So you're able to get off of, even if you don't have your bike with you for the travel, you're able to get off of any subway stop, any rail stop, and find a bike that you can then rent and then access a huge area surrounding that hub. And so it gives people this access that it's hard to picture from the viewpoint of many American cities. And I think it would be so beneficial if we could strive for that, if we could attain anything even close to that. I think it would make a massive difference.
But and even that, though, continues on the conversation of just being a cultural and philosophical battle. You know, in Kentucky, we have, you know, we've brought this up a number of times, how, especially in the Gil Holland interview as well, that the state owns most of the major streets in downtown Louisville. So that means Kentucky, the people in Louisville that want to see bike lanes on their particular street, they can go to the Metro Council members all they want. And Metro Council members and the handful of state legislatures that represent their area can help go lobby to the state. But ultimately, it's the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet that gives the go ahead as to whether or not they can do that. And while that sounds like an interesting and easy enough process to do, it's very difficult. And what you're seeing instead is the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet pushing to get another belt on the highway outside of Louisville. And that just continues to be the philosophical battle that people just don't want to have the conversation about. And it's also frustrating because I think from a fiscal perspective that expanded highways don't make financial sense, right? In that you're constantly expanding, you're constantly having, which means you constantly have more area to repair, more area to maintain, and you're not really easing congestion because more people are going to be driving, more people are going to be commuting further distances. So it's not alleviating any long-term problems. It's just allowing it to continue. And then on the flip side, if you invested more in bike lanes, if you invested more in density, if you invested more in public transportation, then your costs start going down. We're on this, at least in American cities, you're seeing this just non-sustainable path towards never-ending spending on road and highway costs.
I could not imagine that an extra loop, a further outer loop, is going to do anything to improve the accessibility situation in the city of Louisville. I can't.
It would be in Bardstown, Kentucky, which they claim to be bourbon capital of the world. Louisville claims to be bourbon capital of the world. I don't know, really know which one, but it's a good 45 minutes on a straight shot from here with no traffic to get there.
It's so far away. It seems like a gross misuse of funds to try and build up highway infrastructure that far out of the city center of even this, what used to be considered the suburbs. Now I guess we're going to call that like the suburbs. I mean, if there
was another city
access like that, yeah. Like, what is that?
Yeah,
a whole nother city. It just doesn't seem, I think, out of touch with what we should be doing.
And it's just, it seems to be, based on this conversation we've had, based on the book, it just seems to completely conflict with the philosophy of what Europe's going to, what some other major cities in America seem to be going towards. This just seems to be a thing where either you're going to get on the cutting edge of it or you're not. And if you want to compete for businesses, if you want to compete for jobs, you're going to have to do these types of things because people want to live in accessible cities. You know, let's take Houston, for example. Okay. You go downtown Houston in one of their bars or restaurants that are on a couple stories up. You look at one direction, you look north. You'll be in a downtown of Houston. You'll see a bunch of suburbs, and then you'll see another downtown. You look to the east, you'll see a bunch of suburbs in front of you, and then you'll see another downtown. And then you look to the west, same thing. Look to the south, same thing. And it's that they just have like a bunch of really pockets because of their zoning. But you know what they've done? And they had the Final Four there in college basketball a number of years ago. I remember hearing people complain that it wasn't that walkable. You know what they've done? They had a light rail. They're adding bike lanes. They're trying, they're actually even, which is an awesome concept, of using the utility easements where they have the giant power line stands, using those easements and putting bike lanes, bike paths underneath those in what is currently green space.
Oh man.
So that you can connect the city in a route that's not currently being used. You can beautify those areas. You can do other things because the electrical towers go so high in the air. And so a city that was disjointed, that was an economic hub, recognized the fact that they had to become more accessible if they wanted to continue to compete for jobs. And they're one of the third biggest city in America. So they're recognizing it, and they're in a, you know, a land expansive city in a state like Texas. So what does that mean Louisville and cities, mid-sized cities our size should be doing? Is you have to start moving towards that, or you're going to miss out on the economic gain.
We definitely need to, I think, be doing a better job at copying what other cities are doing better than us when it comes to accessibility and city planning with regards to transportation and potentially rail situations, at least bike lanes and bikeability. I think that's maybe where it starts. And we've talked about the chicken and egg. If we start making some of these improvements, the appetite will grow for further improvements, you know?
But I think to counter that argument, though, I think that's part of the issue, is that we've seen what at least Louisville's mayor has done, which is put these disjointed projects together to just kind of test the water and try and force almost like force feed the city some of these things, but without going far enough. And it's played almost too much of a middle ground. And typically I like compromise. I like people finding ways to work together to get things done. But at a certain point with this, cities have to find a way to become more accessible. And if you don't go to a certain point with these projects, both sides are going to be left unhappy.
Definitely. Right? Well, I hate to do it, but as always, we have to sign off at a certain point. Andrew, you have anything else?
No. I think that's let's cut it off before I go on a 2-hour tangent.
Yeah. We've met our match for the day.
Appreciate it, guys. Tune in next week.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. As always, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for joining us on Building This Community. If you'd like any more information, you can follow us on Twitter at BuildingThisCom, COM, or you can follow Andrew
at Andrew J. Klump. And you can also follow Luke
at LMP43. Definitely subscribe, and we look forward to talking to you guys next week.